I take an interest in how stuff works. I would say 10 out of 10 dentists agree that communication sucks in companies. When you stop trying to fit everybody into your mold, it's kind of cool.
Welcome to another episode of Venture Visionaries, where we explore the minds and journeys of remarkable leaders shaping the future of business and technology. Today, we have an extraordinary guest, Larry Gadea, the founder and CEO of Envoy. His story is a compelling tale of resilience, innovation, and visionary leadership that has redefined how companies manage their workplaces. Let's begin with a story that I think captures the essence of Larry's journey. Imagine a young boy in Romania, separated from his parents who fled to Germany in search of a better life. He's left in the care of his grandparents, and he's facing uncertainty and some of the pain and discomfort of a separation. And yet, his parents, undeterred by the risks and spurred by love, smuggle him out of the country and eventually reunite with him in Canada. That boy is Larry. And that adventurous early life, marked by immense challenge and the triumph of reunion, becomes the backdrop of resilience and determination that I believe set the stage for Larry's future endeavors. His fascination with computers began early, inspired by his father, and soon blossomed into a passion for problem solving and reverse engineering. As a teenager, Larry honed his skills by cracking game copy protection and developing plugins for Google desktop search. His technical prowess was so amazing it actually caught the attention of Google, leading to an unexpected recruitment while he was still in high school. Larry's journey took him to Twitter, where he saw firsthand the power of efficient office systems, and it was that inspiration that led him to build Envoy. You see, Larry observed how tech giants like Google and Twitter managed their offices with precision and efficiency. And he saw a big gap in the market for similar solutions in other smaller countries. Today, if you walk into any startup that I'd say is about Series B or more, you kind of expect to get in their offices a true tech-forward, seamless experience. And that's probably because you're using Envoy. Today, Envoy revolutionizes workplace management, offering solutions for visitor management, desk booking, meeting room scheduling, and more across 16,000 locations globally. In our conversation today, Larry recounts his childhood in Romania, the risks his parents took to ensure a better future, and how these experiences shaped his problem-solving abilities. We're going to delve into his early fascination with technology, the skills he developed, some through reverse engineering, most autodidactic, and how this background paved the way for his career at Google and Twitter. Larry and I also discuss the challenges and motivations that drive problem solving. Larry digs deep to explore what drives his deep-seated curiosity and desire for improvement. We also have some honest talk about the downsides of being an overachiever, striving for perfection, and the associated frustrations for all. Larry and team navigated as experts through the pandemic, when Envoy had to adapt rapidly, transforming its product line to meet changing workplace needs. Larry's going to give us a front seat view to that story and how the lessons of resilience and adaptability that Envoy showed are things that any of us can learn from. We're going to explore the impact of tech debt on companies and the importance of embracing challenges as part of the growth process. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are crucial aspects of Envoy's culture. And Larry takes time discussing his genuine commitment to DEI, just how much of it is required to achieve meaningful results, and the various programs and initiatives that he believes have been most effective. We can't talk about workplace automation and rapid change in the workplace without talking about AI and automation. And we will do that with Larry. He's going to underscore the need for companies to recognize the importance these technologies have in improving overall workforce experiences. So join us as we delve into the life and insights of Larry Gadea, exploring his remarkable journey from Romania to leading a revolutionary workplace platform in the Bay Area. This episode promises to inspire and enlighten, offering valuable lessons on resilience, innovation, and visionary leadership. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Larry.
could you describe to me just a little bit about like what was your background and how you found yourself in engineering?
I was born in Romania, and this was like late 80s or something, which means that it is this whole like Ceausescu, all this like crazy stuff around communism and all that. So my parents wanted to get out of there, and they basically left the country with my brother, and then they left me behind with my grandparents. Apparently, that was a normal thing. I still try to accept it today. They went to Germany, and what happened is that the reason they could do that is because they left a child behind, and no parent will leave their child behind. So that's why they could actually travel outside this communist country. They're like, we want our kid. So they had me essentially smuggled out of there and into Germany, where we then all reunited. And then we flew from there to Canada, where my dad found a job with the government doing COBOL. I mean, there's just a lot of like really, really risky moves that they had to do as like parents. And then, I mean, I was brought up in an environment of people needing to work really hard and like figure things out. Everything was always like an uphill battle. Everything is, it's never fair. The system is like, you just have to stand out in order to survive in that kind of world. We somehow got ourselves into Canada. My dad was working for the government there, was really interested in computers the whole time. He was doing like consulting or something for the Canadian government. I don't know if it was because of him or not, but let's just credit him anyways, because he loves hearing that. And I learned a lot about computers, and I learned a lot about different systems, and I got really interested in it. I did a whole lot of game copy protection cracking when I was a kid. So what is that? Back in the day, they used to have floppies and CDs and DVDs eventually, and they didn't want you copying games. But I didn't really like, it's like, cool, okay, whatever, I don't have time to play these games anyways. But I did find it really challenging to like make these games work with a copy of these things, because like they do things like detecting, is this a CDRW or not? There's all sorts of ways of doing that. So the challenge was fun to like reverse engineer it and then like figure it out and then publish it online to be distributed to millions of people all around the world. That was like a cool whatever. I didn't really care about that. What I cared about was the challenge that these big companies were really trying to protect their games. So that was fun. I learned a ton about computers, about reverse engineering, asked me about Securom and all sorts of weird game copy protections. But in the end, I built up a skill set where at the time, so this was like, I'm still in my teens here. Google was released this thing called Google Desktop Search. It lets you search your computer. You could find different files like Microsoft Word documents. If you type in like tree, it will find a document that has the word tree in it. It's not an easy problem to do because these files are compressed and like they're different encodings and all that. So you don't actually get that info. But by doing different, by this Google Desktop software, it would actually go through all the doc files on your computer, index them and get them in there so you could search your computer just as fast as you could the internet. I was in Ottawa, Canada. And if the one fun fact of Ottawa, Canada is Corel WordPerfect is a company that was based there. I used WordPerfect as well because I was in school and like for whatever reason we had a license, so I used it. And then Google launched the software and I was like, oh, it doesn't support WordPerfect. Oh, this sucks. I can't use it. But of course, I was like super into Google. So what I ended up doing is writing a plugin system for Google Desktop Search to allow it to have external things like WordPerfect. So in comes a phone call from Google and they're like, what are you doing? You're not allowed to do this. Also, come work here.
Yeah.
So I didn't expect that. And that was a little bit surprising, but because I was expecting like, oh no, this is it. Like 17-year-old me is going straight to like Juvie Center. Like I'm a goner. And it turns out that they were like, no. We understand that you're violating the law, but like you should come and work here. They didn't know how old I was at the time. So I went through the interview process and everything. Because of course it's Google. Oh my God, why would I not want to? Like, I know these days people find reasons to hate these big companies, but like back in the day, like there's a lot of respect for like innovators of technology. And I was super into them. I interviewed, I got the job. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And they're like, cool, when can you start? And I'm like, well, okay, I need to kind of get like past high school first because they're going to need like, and I need a degree as well, or else they won't let me into the US. So that was a real problem. And then they were like, what? And then you could just hear them in the back, like, what just happened? Like, did we not check this stuff? We can't hire a minor. So we had to do all this stuff. I eventually got in through some kind of this, like, it was like an internship that lasted 4 years long. And I just did that. So I was in school, I was at Google for the summers and whenever I was on break. And then when I wasn't on break, I would be back in Ottawa and I was going to a school there, Carleton University. So I did my schooling, got graduated out of there. I decided that, like, you know, Google, it's fun and everything, but I knew I always wanted to start a company and I wanted to go through the what is absolute headache of running a company. I went to learn about it. So I moved here to San Francisco, where I still am and am now, 2008, 2009. I joined Twitter. We were like 40 people at the time. If you remember the fail whale, those are the glory days, if you can imagine that. From there, I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to take a little bit of time off and then finally start a thing. Eventually, I ended up starting Envoy. And Envoy was just based off of my observations of when I was at Google. I was like, this is really thought through. And then I discovered that Facebook had built their own stuff. Apple had built their own stuff too. And the stuff I saw at Google, they built themselves too. And then when I went to Twitter, stark contrast, where everything was on fire all the time, and in a good way, but it was on fire. So what that means is that nothing stopped through because everybody's running for the most absolute prioritized thing. And basically I was like, I bet you there's a bunch of companies out there that would really just want what Google, Facebook, Apple built for themselves, except they don't got the time for it. So let's sell them something. And that's how Envoy started. It started as a visitor management product because it was a very stark difference. Like, people paid a lot of money for their front desk, lobby, they had receptionists, all this fancy stuff. But it's kind of like the companies that didn't have that. You didn't know where to go. The door is slightly propped open. Am I expected to go through? All that kind of stuff. And the experience of it all was just missing. Visitor's product had inherent growth. Just people go to people's offices. They have to sign in. They kind of had to. And then they were like, oh, this wasn't terrible.
I'm struck by a couple of things in this story so far. You seem to be like an incessant problem solver, right? Where do you kind of trace the origin of not just your ability to kind of perceive problems, but see them as solvable?
Engineering is a field that typically attracts a lot of people that are high in curiosity. When I go home, I'm going to watch weird videos as to like how the SR-71 worked or how like steam locomotive works. Mm-hmm. It's like, why do I watch it? Am I going to build an airplane? Maybe, but more likely I'm just going to be interested in like the kinds of problems that they're solving. And it's just, I don't know, it's something I take an interest in how stuff works. And I think that that's how, by understanding how something works, you can really accomplish really big things when it's a real important thing. That's essentially, I think, how it ends up being. It's naturally motivating to kind of figure out, like, you use the thing a couple of times, but then you're like, how can I make it better? Because I also get annoyed at stuff that isn't working quite the way that I would expect it to. So then I want to make it better.
At least in terms of what it means to build and innovate, it served you well. The other question is, and you just briefly touched on this in your history, and that you've moved around quite a bit. Do you think that needing to move around in so many different places and learn so many different cultures so early influenced the way that you think about new places or new problems? And I'm very specifically curious about what is the thing that you find perhaps easier, more intuitive than the people you look around you who haven't had the same kind of global experience?
One thing the environment does do is it kind of shows you what's normal. It's not like not that if you see anything enough times, it basically is normal. So in Canada, they have a very, let's just call it, lenient immigration policy. So what that means is that you get literally everybody of every color of the rainbow that shows up there, including myself. We also had our participation awards. So don't get me wrong. Like, we also were encouraged all the time to like do everything, and everything was great. Canada in particular is a great place to go to like just be indoctrinated that everyone's awesome. That's basically it.
You were building a visitor management software and system, and then this little thing called the COVID-19 pandemic.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, just a little thing there.
And what was it like to navigate that challenge as a company? And how has that shifted or shaped how Envoy thinks about themselves?
I'd say like somebody like myself, like just having started a company when there's literally one person here, and it's now it's like, what is it, 250 or something like that. But it's like, thing about people like me is like, we're just people in general. They always think of like the past as like, oh yeah, no, everything was better then. Oh yeah, back in my day and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, like that applies to all ages. But it's also a little bit like, oh yeah, no, it was so much, like I had a lot of really fun moments when the company was so much smaller. Yeah, I really liked that we could innovate and create new things. And all that I saw it as when this pandemic hit is that it was like an opportunity to go back to our roots and build again and build new things and really innovate. The problem with companies that are reasonably successful is that you kind of get in this trap of like, it's working, let's double down on it, as opposed to like, it's working, let's double down on it, and let's do totally risky things that are completely unproven. That doesn't happen very often. The vision of our company has always been to be like much more transformative for the workplace, to like automate everything around it, to like really help facilitate everything, and really have people just much more focused on their day and like really get all the little paper cuts out of the way. We were forced into doing something else when the pandemic started. Knowing now what it ended up happening is, it sounds a lot more dramatic, I would say, than it is. Like in the list of, what was it, narcissism and like all those other wonderful words. Another one on there is like denial is a really big one too. So what you notice is that like the whole world was like, oh, no, don't worry, we'll be back in the office in 2 weeks. Oh, no, don't worry. In September, the kids are back in school. So obviously the parents need to go back to work. And these are like the government, like, oh, no, in January, God, the holiday break is over. So obviously people, it's just like, it was the most silly of rationale. It made absolutely no rational sense, but like people kind of played along, and so did our customers, and so did people's just mindset. So that's why like the return to office has always just kept on happening. All these certain periods, it was always after the holidays, it was after September, it was after, and it just kind of kept on going. So that kept our customers active, but they were not buying visitors because they had visitors. Yeah. They needed something to keep track of their employees because their employees now were mandated by law. First of all, most municipalities had rules like 5% maximum occupancy in any office. So by law, they needed to track that. After a while, like people needed to keep track of like vaccines, or they needed to keep track of like COVID tests. So that kind of stuff was required by law again. So it's kind of like we ended up building this product line where we basically took the visitors product, we transformed it into like, well, every employee is now a visitor. And actually it worked pretty well. We added like required mandatory questions. We added like COVID uploads. You could scan your little QR code and like we'd validate it. We added all this functionality, but what got interesting is we added desk booking. Now, the desk booking was to keep people like you would say, like, hey, I'm going to come in. And what would happen is these are social people. So they'd want to like sit near each other. And it's like, hey, how's COVID going for you? Yeah, good. How about you? Good. But if we don't want people near each other, first of all, regulations, but second, they're going to make each other sick again. So what we had to do, we built a whole hot desking product around keeping people away from each other. Well, it turns out as more and more people came in, they wanted to have meetings together. So now they needed to organize that and make sure that people aren't using the same rooms and that they'd be cleaned after a meeting and or after the day, the desk would be cleaned. So we ended up amassing this employee-focused product suite, which, by the way, we'd always wanted to do. Now, we didn't want to do it for COVID purposes, but we wanted to just do it for just our company so we could have more products. Over time, what's happened is what was used to keep people away from each other now is used to bring them together on hybrid schedules. And people would have their teams together and they'd have a meeting room pre-planned and they'd have parking. So basically, we ended up pivoting our products more and more. Ask me about tech debt, but it's basically it ended up in a world where it's just really a powerful suite of different products that now we have a whole workplace product line. And that is all about the employee experience and efficiencies and calculating space utilization. So the CFO can save money and all that kind of stuff. So it has transformed our company a lot, but it just goes back to an inherent desire to find problems and things that I don't know what to attribute that to.
You've talked a lot about how Larry keeps this innovative mindset and kind of how Larry keeps curious and being a problem solver and adjusting and innovating. But Envoy is no longer just Larry. What has been your journey of transferring those kinds of culture and values onto your team? Where do you think you've done it really well? And where would you like to do it even better?
Personalities vary dramatically between people. The people we're hiring today probably would not have ended up starting companies on their own. It is people that expect a lot more structure. It is people that expect career paths. It is people that expect like certainty and clarity. And I think that is, you have to be able to adapt to working with those kinds of people. Where you or me might be like really into like, oh yeah, I want to do crazy things all the time. crazy things all the time doesn't scale. What it does is it creates something, but you can't get it out to more than like a few hundred customers or something like that. You want to get into thousands, tens of thousands, millions of customers, you're going to need people that can really execute on like very important pieces of something much bigger. So it's kind of like telling the story in a way and understanding people's like where they come from and like what their role is and ensuring that like the communication down the chain happens is one of the hardest things. I would say 10 out of 10 dentists agree that communication sucks in companies.
Yeah.
And it's always terrible. And it's kind of like we do our best to be slightly better than absolutely terrible, which I would say is like, is probably top percentile. But no, we're certainly not top percentile in communication, but we do our best. Kind of like being very conscious of the fact that we have to repeat our messages. It's like whenever we announce any kind of news, it has to be said three times in three different channels. Mm-hmm. So either like one in like our weekly all hands, one in like email, and then one maybe like Slack or yeah, whatever we're using. I think repetition is really important. And I think people will adapt as well. Like people always have little, like deep down, they wish they could be more risk-taking or had more time to do the exploratory thing. So they see by leading by example, I think it helps a lot too. And kind of showing people that it's okay. And like they can try it and they can do it. This is a very engineering mindset. I mean, this is like bread and butter, what Google trained us to be like.
What is your idea of the ideal Envoy employee of today? And when you look ahead, do you envision that continuing to evolve?
I would say just the person that owns what they do, where they really like really, really own it, where it's like if it breaks, they like jump in and try to fix it. If it's good, they jump in and try to make it even better. Like somebody who really like lives and breathes and takes pride. Like I think pride is extremely important. Pride also has extreme downsides. You get egomaniacs, you get narcissists, you get like all this kind of stuff. I like to say that like the best executives, the best like leaders are actually like egomaniacs, but like they're very controlled about it. Some people are less controlled about it, but even the most humble of people that are in leadership positions, like they're very excited about themselves and what they can impact, but they're also trying to be very thoughtful about others in the process. Mm-hmm. I try my best to do that too. And it's kind of like it works and sometimes you fail horribly, but like it's the concept is just, yeah, the humility is kind of universally liked.
What are some of the ways that you think you've especially grown as a leader?
Yeah, it turns out not everyone is an engineer. Fun fact. And really? Not everyone cares. Yeah, I know it's a shocker. I know it's a shocker, but like not everyone is exactly the same as you. And I remember one of my execs from a long time ago, he was like, yeah, Larry is very interesting. He hasn't figured out that other people are different yet. And I like overheard him say that. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, but maybe one day I will. And no, it absolutely is that way. Some people want to be thanked in different ways. They appreciate different things in life. It's the openness to like that others are different. And I know that that's like a very common statement these days, but there is a real reality and just that there is a world where you could be very wrong and like, that's fine. And then just like kind of accept it. I think that that's really, really tough for folks and even for me. But I mean, I don't know, again, keeping things different all the time just gets you in this world that like change is okay. And like, whatever, let's deal with it now. It's going to be great. And I don't know, I'm pretty open-minded on things, but I will get pretty close-minded on certain things that I feel like I've seen the pattern before.
Does that mean you think that you find yourself more open-minded and more open to different perspectives today?
I used to try to hire my revenue leaders because like if they had like an engineering degree, like that would be a huge up. Somewhere along the road, they like took a wrong turn and ended up in sales. And that's how I used to think. I used to think they took a wrong turn somewhere. Now, yeah. I say that kind of jokingly, but I genuinely thought that like 10 yeah. years ago, if you rewind me 10 years ago, they like, yeah, they couldn't make it and they ended up there. But it turns out that like customers don't like talking to engineers. Engineers also highlight the wrong things. This is not going to work if you don't recognize that different people like different things. My current revenue leader, like, I mean, when we were talking over, like for when we were interviewing at the end of the process and stuff, he invited me over for cigars. I am not a cigar person, but when he said that, I was like, this is the guy. The reason is because it is like, it's totally not something I would do. It's totally not an engineering thing, but like it is absolutely a revenue people leader org of hundreds, thousands of people kind of thing. And like this guy runs revenue, this guy runs sales, this guy runs customer happiness and success. And like, this is who they are. And it's kind of like when you really are okay with it and really understand it, it's, I don't know. So now I've been having the success of a lifetime with him right now. And it's just kind of like when you stop trying to fit everybody into your mold, it's kind of cool. Like, you can be really surprised.
Do you find that that growth in learning to let people do their thing ever comes into conflict with like your engineering desire to fix it and get it right? How do you decide when you're going to lean in versus pull back?
It's really tough. When I was, I don't know if it's younger or just earlier career, I would just be like, okay, this guy's going down the wrong path. Like, this is bad. I need to step in here or else we're going to waste months and months of time. I still get that like sense and I still want to do that here and there. But these days I've just like pattern matched a lot more where I can see that like, no, this guy knows what's up. If he screws it up, he's going to fix it as well. Like, that's one thing that I had forgotten in the earlier days, that like, you let these people screw up something, like they will learn from that and they won't make that mistake again, at least the good ones. A lot of time, I think it can come off as trust issues where you're like not trusting someone to like to make a mistake. And it's kind of like, yeah, a little bit, you're kind of just wanting to optimize and make things faster. And like, you don't want to waste all this time by that person doing the dumb thing. Maybe there's a world where it might look dumb to you and it might actually be dumb, but like, it's actually good net because the person learned something. They now know to like do something completely different. And even if they did it and it was good, then it's like, great, let's double down on that thing. It's also kind of how competitive advantages can come up too, where it's like you're identifying new ways of doing things that your competitors maybe wouldn't have thought because it was a terrible idea, but it wasn't really.
Did you have people who you now think back on as mentors? And do you see people within Onboard Beyond who you mentor today?
There's definitely, this is a common thing where like people will see people that remind them of themselves. That's a very dangerous bias, might I add, but like it is a thing that people do. So like you see like somebody that's like, oh man, this person's like making all the same mistake. Usually they're way younger and they like, they're just like getting started in their career. They're doing all these like random hacks of different things and you like converse with them. And absolutely there are people at the company here, especially in engineering, that I'll be that way with. I would say that, yeah, I think that there's a lot to learn from others and just what kind of the things you're doing.
I'm very curious about the piece you mentioned on the risk of bias. Could you say a bit more?
You see good and you want to replicate good. And if you've seen it all like in one type of company or in multiple types of companies, you're going to just assume that that's what it looks like. It's one of the things I hire for is people that have been at a company and they've seen what really great looks like. It could be very literal the way that some people's memories work, especially like more kind of image-based people. Like they will remember what like really good looks like down to what the person looks like. Yeah. Hey, it's like an HR leader that's a woman and they're like roughly this tall and roughly this age group. I don't know if people use like subconscious a lot as a way of kind of identifying where it's like, it's not intentional, but it happens anyways. And that's, I think, how these things start. You're trying to just pattern match because you're also trying to pattern match around this is how they speak. This is how they like, how they stand up. This is what their presence is like. Yeah. And when you're thinking about 200 different factors for like what great looks like, it's very easy to also associate certain things like their certain heights. And that's how I think a lot of these subconscious or unconscious biases happen, because it's kind of like people are just like trying to run this network of like 1,000 different factors. And it's like, yeah, these things will slip. The ones that want to correct themselves are really the people that really get it. They recognize that, oh, geez, we shouldn't try to simplify there. It comes up a lot, especially in hiring, especially in like just operations of a company. It's very hard too. It's very subjective. And that's where biases are tough. It's hard to scale a certain bias mindset, if that makes sense. Like, we don't want to bias, or we want to like really bias towards performance. It's kind of like, okay, well, if for performance anybody can do, but like that actually accurate, like during the same hours, during the same days, like same country, because we were now in multiple countries. And and I think that's where like unfairnesses can happen. Again, none of it's intentional. People are just looking for shortcuts, but some shortcuts shouldn't be taken.
Can you walk me through your personal connection to DEI and why that has been important for you and your organization in the ways that it has?
I feel like, so the companies that were saying it before, like, I bet you they were genuinely like thinking that, but they just were not able to execute on it. And it takes work. Like, that's the thing. It takes work to create a great DEI program and to have the proper hiring, to not just use an excuse that the pipeline is such and such. Therefore, that's why it takes a lot of work in a company to be okay acknowledging that, like, no, we're going to have to work twice as hard for half the results. But like, once we get those people in, it'll really, really help us. I'm usually very insistent on that our systems are fair. They're not equal, but they're fair. So what that means is, like, when it comes to comp, like, it's comp season, so all the comp talk comes up, and it's kind of like, I really want a system that's very rigid. Like, managers should not have discretion as to how much money their people get paid, but they should have discretion as to how much, what the scores are. So how do they do? But also, so should their peers. And also, so should peers that they didn't even select. So there's things around making a system kind of more fair by involving more people, but also just like making it fair for everyone. So it doesn't matter who you are or what your background is, so long as, let's just say, you perform, which is a very corporate way of looking at it. But I would just say, like, so long as the fundamental, like, business need is being met and it's better than others, then you get more than others. We see results from all types of folks, and hiring is always a challenge, but they like seeing that we have real events on. They like attending those. Like we'll do things like, hey, encourage your friends who are of the, like, if we're having a Black Ad event or if we're having, like, a Women Ad event, hey, bring them to this event. Like, we have free drinks. Like, who doesn't want that? And it's kind of like, I don't know, we just try to make it a little bit fun.
Could you walk to me some of the challenges you've encountered or Envoy's encountered in building a diverse and inclusive team? And what were some of the ways that you worked hard or figured out how to address those?
We just have a bunch of different programs. Like, we have, for example, we have ERGs.
Yeah.
And in these ERGs, it's like different ones. We have Black Ad, we have Women Ad, we have Latinx Ad, and we have a whole bunch of others. And it's kind of like, okay, this is really great. Getting the ERGs to be, like, accountable to what their cause is also a thing. So we have these executive sponsors, and on the executive team, everybody has to be part of an ERG, at least one, and to, like, support it. But also, given that you're dealing with corporate executives, what you get is a whole bunch of goal setting and timelines. But it makes it real. So then, like, that event you were at, they had to get at least a couple hundred people in the building or else they don't get budget next quarter. There's something about, like, if we're going to do it, we got to do it for real. And putting these kinds of incentives, and also just like, hey, guys, we're not just here to just talk about random fun things. We want to, like, further the cause, but also, like, make sure it's working and make sure it's fun and make sure, like, if we can do something better, we do. Yeah. So there's definitely a lot of that. And we also just try to be transparent about things too. Like, it's the transparency in the company does help for equalizing everything. Our transparency will go everything from, like, the pay scales and stuff to, like, what kind of data we share. We share, like, even survey results, how our company's doing, our ENPS, which is always a crowd favorite as to, like, oh, why are people not recommending each other more? Like, what can we do better? Well, maybe if we didn't have an RTO, we wouldn't have this be this bad. And, like, it's like, no, we're not going to solve it by running away from each other, people. This is the kind of stuff that, like, the more transparent you are, the more, I think, trust building happens. We're still working on all these. Like, I mean, I'm telling some of the happier stories here, but there's a lot of work that we have to do internally too. Really do unify people more. And especially when people are away from each other, they're, like, on Zoom calls, they live in other cities, and they don't have that inherent trust building that happens when you're in person.
Yeah.
And also, when you're in person, it accelerates all the negative stuff too. So if two people don't like each other, but they see each other every day, that's also not great. It only accelerates the animosity between them.
Is there a failure or setback you feel comfortable sharing that led to an unexpected success or learning?
The whole pandemic is a gimme on that one. I mean, that was one hell of an uphill battle. Like, it's the whole world is going against you. I mean, we even had people internally in the company that were like, hey, why don't we just keep selling the visitors product? There's some industries like manufacturing that haven't even left their office or their building. Why don't we just sell more to them? And there's always going to be, 25% of people in a company will always disagree with you. And it's kind of like, you just have to get used to that.
I'm curious what emerging trends in tech you really are most excited about right now.
I think obviously AI, like anybody these days will give you that, but it's, as an engineer, I value optimization. I value everyone being worth a lot. So every one person should be very, very, very valuable to any one company. And if they're not, then that means something broken. Like, all these tools that are coming out now are pretty massive. Like, the types of efficiencies that you can get from your business, and not to, like, self-promote too much here, but, like, to get automation around your workplace, and especially, like, the front desk, and to have that person not just be able to deal with visitors, but also be able to deal with deliveries, also be able to deal with your office, also be able to deal with scheduling the food, also be able to deal with the parking, also be able to deal with the insurance, also be able to deal with the vendors and the replacing of the light bulbs and the air conditioner that just will not turn off. And it's like 6 o'clock and it's still freezing in here. And it's just to be able to deal with all of those things. Mm-hmm. There's no superhuman that can do it without great automation. Mm-hmm. CFOs are also taking the reins in a lot of companies. What that means is that like they're questioning every purchase. They're making sure everything hits either they're making money, they're saving a lot of money, or it's some kind of insurance. And it's like, those are the three reasons that a CFO will even listen to you. So I think it's really important that like companies recognize that as well. Like it is, it's a trend that is extremely important. But I would say like experience is not how your company is going to do well. Like it's not going to like just creating a great experience. Like that is literally one of our core values. That is not enough. There's no way. In the past, people would love Envoy because, oh, it's so easy to use. Oh, yeah, I can like, it's, I don't have to like have these headaches anymore. Oh, it's like you click a button and actually does the thing it's supposed to. Bar isn't very high in SaaS software, let me just tell you. But what's interesting is that's really hard. Like, it's kind of like you cannot sell on that stuff. You have to sell on this will save you money. This will, you'll be able to rent out your meeting rooms on a marketplace and you will make money. Like that's what a CFO wants to hear when they're buying stuff, or they want to hear, hey, you don't need three receptionists anymore. You just need one and the other's an office manager. And then the other one is coordinating things around real estate. Mm-hmm. Like that is a completely different thing, saving a whole bunch of work, saving a whole bunch of cost. And at the same time, it's a multiplier for everybody in that office. Yeah. So I just think in general, it's really important for people to recognize the automation that's happening. AI is part of it. We're working on a lot of really, really cool projects that are going to involve a lot of like automation when it comes to like, hey, what's your front desk going to do if your front desk person's in the bathroom or they are sick that day? What's going to happen? And I think there's a lot of really cool stuff that hasn't been done before can be done there.
I want you to think about three different people. Larry at 8, Larry at 17, and Larry starting Envoy. What advice would you want to give to each of them?
Larry's starting Envoy, don't get in the, like, don't just keep doing the visitors thing forever. It's gonna scale. Don't worry about it. But like, you can do so much more all at once. You just need to like hire faster. So do that. And also your investors will give you a lot more money if you tell them you're going to do a whole lot more things too, as opposed to just highlighting how good your current revenue line is. Yeah. Larry at 17 is like, hey, I know you love the details and things, and I know that like you love digging in, but people really don't like it when you guess their details and like what they think is really special. And just because you're a smart ass, you like have just told them the answer to their thing that they've just been fighting for weeks for. That doesn't help anyone, especially you when it comes to them not being motivated anymore. Let people discover it on their own. And also, you're not always right anyway, so stop it. And maybe that goes into the 8-year-old Larry, which is, stop thinking that you're always right, because you're not. And then especially when you're not right, please like notice how you were wrong and like stop all the egos thing, because it's just like it's enough. People are recognizing it. Please just acknowledge it.
Is there anything either about who you are or who Envoy is that you wanted to share that I didn't ask the right questions for you to get across?
I don't know. There are a lot of questions here about like uphill battles and a lot about like going against the norm. I just generally, I would want to reiterate that. Like, I think it's to be able to go against the norm, you need a lot of encouragement. So my encouragement here is just for everyone that, I don't know, just people like to just stop doing what you think you're supposed to be doing and like do it the way that you want to be doing and the way that you think is going to be different and better. Because the market, the world acknowledges who's unique and special, not who's like complacent to everything.
Wherever possible, I want to hear from more than just the CEO or executive director of an organization. I'm always really curious how the experiences of the people who are actually making these organizations work reflect on the company's vision, and quite frankly, the leader's ability to execute on it. This week, I got to chat with Caitlin Cam, Director of People Growth at Envoy. And I had one question for her. What does she love about Envoy? I loved what she had to say.
I love Envoy because I get to be an envoy. I get to come to this incredible workplace with awesome different kinds of people that are all working together to create the best in class workplace experience and deliver on that. I don't just love what I do. I do what I love at Envoy, and I genuinely look forward to coming to work every single day. So no Sunday scaries for me.
And so that brings us to the end of today's episode and our glimpse into Larry's fascinating, wild, inspiring story. Not all of us are going to end up being smuggled across the border for a better life. But all of us will be faced with moments of choice where we have to take a risk and bet on ourselves, where we realize that the status quo is not working and that we either accept what will certainly not serve us or go forth boldly to what might. As you face those moments, dear listener, I wish you courage. I wish you grace on yourself. But most of all, I wish you imagination, that you would get a glimpse of what might just be possible if you try. As always, I'm Thomas Agema. I'll see you soon.